But ultimately, you know, I think we got a lot of folks who are in these positions to the point now where at least when they see a community and they see its problems and they come up with solutions before trying to implement them, they actually go and get feedback on the plan. And I would say that's a step in the right direction. But how about even better, before you come up with the solutions and decide which problems you're going to solve, you start from with the people in the neighborhood and say, what are your problems? Really? What do you see as your big problem? Because frequently it's you won't hear the same answer. In Detroit, at least, crime is the perfect example. We see crime data in a neighborhood and we say, aha, we want more cops. But if you actually go and talk to the people in the neighborhood, they don't want more cops. They don't feel safer when the cops are there, to be honest. The cops don't seem to work for them. What they say is, I want to know more of my neighbors. I feel safer when I actually know my community more.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a great conversation with Ned Stabler, the president and CEO of TechTown, a Detroit-based entrepreneur hub helping startups and local businesses launch and grow. Ned tells us about his background, his passion for inclusive economic growth in the city of Detroit, before sharing with us what a smart community is to him, and how his love for a sense of community led him into the smart community space. Ned then tells us about TechTown, how they started, and some examples of the businesses that they have helped, before discussing the history of Detroit and how its communities have evolved and changed over time. We then discuss the importance of end user and public engagement when planning and making decisions for communities, as well as the need for diverse skill sets to then build solutions for those communities. We then discuss people's own skill sets and how important it is to recognize our own strengths and weaknesses to be successful in business. We finish our conversation discussing the emerging trends of telemedicine and teleconferencing and how these can give much better access to healthcare in communities. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Ned. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, and I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Absolutely. So I'm Ned Stabler. I'm the president of an organization called TechTown in Detroit, Michigan. I'm also the vice president for economic development at Wayne State University, which is a big public research university right in the middle of the city of Detroit. I'm passionate about inclusive economic growth. How do we make the city of Detroit work for everybody? You know, Detroit has a long and storied past, but also, and some of it is wonderful, and much of it is a story of segregation and institutional racism, and an economy that in the past has only worked for the people at the very top. And so our mission is, as we rebuild the city's economy, that we make sure that everyone across the city has an opportunity to participate in growth so that it can become sustainable also equitable.
Yeah, excellent. And I haven't been to Detroit yet, but I really can't wait to come there at some point in probably the distant future now. I thought it was going to be closer. I was in America in 2019 and I nearly had Detroit on my list, but I just couldn't squeeze it in the time that I was there. But yeah, I'm really excited to talk more about Detroit and I guess the journey that Detroit has been on in the past as well. So let's first go to smart communities. What is a smart community to you?
So to me, a smart community is a place that works for its residents. It's really that simple. I know that some people go right to, when they hear the word smart, they think, oh, IoT and mobility and fancy, innovative solutions. And yes, bringing technology to create new solutions to make cities work better for all of its residents, absolutely is a part of it. But I also like to think that we don't have to overthink it or get too fancy. Sometimes smart cities are smart because they just work, not because, the most technologically advanced place on earth. You know, sometimes I think we get caught up in the new cool, hip technology and forget that, you know, sometimes simple things work too. If we've brought along the community to help design and build them to solve their actual needs. So I think that's an important part, is who cities work for and less about how fancy the solutions we design are.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, tell us why, how you got into this kind of, I guess, tech space, smart community space, or community space.
Yeah, sure. So I was always planning on going into some sort of public service my whole life. And I went off to university and planned to study how that worked and decided, took a little bit of a detour and decided to go out and see the real world for a little while and go into, quote, business. I figured I'd do that for a couple of years, figure out how the real world worked, and then get back to, you know, being a part of a progressive change, you know, because when you're 20 years old, you can maybe think you can figure everything out in about 2 years. So instead of 2 years, I ended up 10 years later, waking up working for a global money center investment bank in London, you know, 3,000 miles away from my home and not a part of a community at all. And I was miserable. And I realized that what really makes me happy, and I think for most people, or a lot of people at least, is a sense of community and being rooted in where they live. I very much felt like I was on a very long vacation. I lived there for 5 years and it never felt quite like home. So my wife and I moved back home about 15, 16 years ago. And ever since I've woke up every day trying very hard to make my community a better place.
Excellent. I love it. And let's talk about Tech Town and tell us how that started and what your goal is and, yeah, a little bit of that background.
So Tech Town as an idea started about 20 years ago, but we didn't physically really get off the ground until about 16 years ago. And it was really meant to commercialize technology out of Wayne State University and our local nonprofit health system called Henry Ford Health System. Its official name is actually the Wayne State University Research and Technology Park. So you can see how old it has as an idea. It was meant to be sort of like the Research Triangle in North Carolina, a place where technology got commercialized and people worked with universities. We very quickly expanded our scope to include non-university or health system folks. And then interestingly, about 9 years ago, we expanded again our services. So the same sort of teachings that we were using to help people commercialize high technology, intellectual property-based businesses, we discovered it worked really well for other things. And Detroit really needed bakeries and coffee shops and restaurants and barber shops and services and amenities. And so now we help all sorts of businesses to start and to grow, regardless of whether it's a mobile app, a medical device, or a barbershop.
Yeah, wow. And you said you've been doing this for like how long, Tech Town?
I've been at Wayne State for 10 years. This is actually our... when the president of the university a couple presidents ago created something, decided they needed to get more engaged in economic development and be a better sort of corporate or university citizen, if you will. I got a call from a headhunter and they said, the president wants to meet you. And I came down and met with him and he said, I want you to do economic development for the university. And I said, what's economic development for a university? And he said, I don't know. Let's figure it out. So that was literally 10 years ago. It was just me. Today, including all the folks at Tech Town, there are about 70 of us running around, all practitioners. So we're not studying economic development, although there certainly are people at the university who are doing that. We're actually, you know, working on it. We're actually working on making a better place, creating more talent, and building stronger businesses in our community.
Mm. Can you give us some examples of some of those businesses you've helped or some of the activities that you do?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there are, you know, real things that you would think of, traditional things that you would think of in terms of, say, technology. So, for example, 4 or 5 years ago, a guy walked in our office. He was an auto engineer, and he had been a victim of a gun incident when he was a child and had always wanted to make guns safer. And he literally walked into our office one day with a sketch of a biometric gun lock. So use your fingerprint, still was able to, you know, people in America are crazy about their guns, and crazy being the operative word. And they very much would like to, you know, they think if I can't get to my gun right away, I'm not safe, which is insane, but it's how they roll. So this allowed people to be locked up so a kid couldn't get their hands on it, but also access to it quickly. And we helped them not just, you know, take it off that napkin and actually develop it. And then you can go into the store and buy it now. or you can go on Amazon like everyone else and buy it. So it's, you know, there's things like that. And then there's restaurants where folks have been cooking out of their kitchen and catering and whatnot. And we've helped them first get a food truck or pop up at a farmer's market. And now there's restaurants open all over the city. And, you know, it's why I get so fat, because I call it economic development when I go out to support our clients.
Living the business class lifestyle, I see. Yep.
We'll get you to Detroit and you'll see. These are, you know, there are a couple of sort of fancier restaurants, but for the most part, they're pretty standard stuff, although the food is excellent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the most important part, right? I love it. Okay, that's really interesting. And I guess let's go back a little bit to, like, for people that don't know the history of Detroit and where they came from. And because Detroit gets talked about a lot in the smart city space, that things are changing, technology is being embraced, et cetera, but definitely that community aspect as well. So can you give us a little bit of background and what's changed in the time that you've been there?
So Detroit, I mean, when most people hear Detroit, I mean, I guess it depends who you are. Some people might think of Motown music or Eminem or electronica even, because all of that sort of started here. But most people think of cars, right? We were the motor city, the capital of the automotive, world's automotive industry. And we still are home to a couple of the biggest auto companies in the world. But auto companies have come a long way. And I'll say that, you know, if you go back 60, 70 years ago, Detroit was one of the richest cities on the planet because of the wealth from our manufacturing expertise. The city of Detroit itself had 1.9 million people living in it in 1950. By the year 2000, it was under a million people. So you had sort of the deurbanization of the city. You had a vast change in manufacturing and auto manufacturing, where people weren't required as much to make the products. So whereas in 1950, you could roll out of high school, walk down the street to an auto plant and get a really good job that would allow you to live an upper middle class lifestyle and maybe have a vacation home and a boat. Those disappeared in the 1980s and 1990s, first with the advent of mechanization, robots and the automation revolution. And then later in the 90s and in 2000 from NAFTA and some trade agreements, which allowed the ability to do it far else. We still make a ton of things in Detroit, which is why you're hearing about us in the mobility conversation. The Ford Rouge plant, which at one point during World War II, actually, or shortly thereafter, employed about 100,000 people, now actually produces a higher value of goods every day than it did 60, 70 years ago, but it does it with less than 4,000 people. So it's just a far less labor-intensive process. But we still make these things here. And as the automotive industry is transforming itself into an electrified drivetrain and into an autonomous vehicle mobility solution provider, that's why Detroit is so well positioned in those spaces. Now, as an economic developer, we still realize you don't need the 100,000 people anymore to do this, but you are going to need higher skilled, higher wage people to develop the technology that does the connected vehicles, that does the autonomous vehicles. So when people talk about smart city in Detroit, they almost always go straight to mobility and start thinking about vehicles as their first way. But obviously, there's a lot more to it than just that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's where I have heard Detroit mainly mentioned in the, yeah, definitely the mobility space, but also just in the, I guess, the changing in the communities and how community building can work when, you know, things are changing so quickly.
Yeah, lots and lots of change. And of course, giving a history like that of the city of Detroit in, you know, a minute and a half doesn't quite do it justice, nor does it cover the multitude of societal and socioeconomic changes that we had. It really is a fascinating story. You know, everyone, whenever they talk about Detroit, always starts just as I did with 1950, us having 1.9 million people, and 2000, us having, you know, just under a million. So a million people left in 50 years. No one starts, except Tom Segrew, who wrote The Origins of the Urban Crisis, highly recommend it, and me when I'm doing a presentation based on that book, where I think you really need to start, which is in 1915. Because from 1915 to 1925, a million people showed up in the city of Detroit. So literally in just 10 years, a million people showed up. People thought it was a huge flight when over 50 years, a million people left. But in 10 years, they showed up. There was no urban planning. There was no code, really. There was no zoning around of this growth that exploded in the city. And you were dealing with a huge amount of racism around housing policy, around hiring policy and in jobs. We really created a microcosm of American Northern industrial / institutional racism mess in the city of Detroit. And we did it so much faster and bigger than other places, which is why it's taken us so much longer to start to get on the other side of it.
And like, you've worked across, I guess, a number of different industries now. How do you think the whole space of communities and community building, how do you think we can integrate better across, you know, academia, business, and then the public sector?
I think the most important thing in any of that is something that everyone pays lip service to, but relatively infrequently actually does, which is to think about the end user. And in urban planning, those are the people that live there. I think obviously where you live is very different from where I live and how we approach things like that. But certainly in America, when we think of urban planning, we rarely think about the residents who actually live there. And our institutions in those spaces, especially in academia, are usually way, way behind. So, for example, for generations, investment in cities often meant building highways to move goods, you know, to and fro easier from these factories and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Completely ignoring the people these highways were ripping through. You know, we talked about getting to point A to point B, but we never talked about everybody in between. And so for years and years, and even to this day, we're still doing some projects where they say we're investing billions of dollars in your community. And I say, no, you're investing billions of dollars to destroy my community. They're really different things. So ultimately, the point of these smart cities is to work. The point of cities is to work for the people who live there. And yet so often many of the decisions or the white papers or the policies that affect them are being made by people who don't live there and aren't a part of it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point when we're making decisions of people that don't live there. And it doesn't mean that those people, you know, experts can't be involved in the conversation. It means that you bring the people that live there along the journey. So then you can also not even just bring them along the journey. I've said that a number of times in the podcast, but thinking about it more and more, the journey is theirs, right? The people that live there, and it's their journey. So you're actually just there along for the ride and gaining those insights to be able to make better decisions. So I think people have lots of conversations about community engagement, and, you know, it's obviously like, you know, methodologies and all that type of stuff as well. But I think, the journey that we're on is for the community, and then what inputs does the community need? And maybe it is technical expertise in a certain device or data or planning. Actually, it'll be all of those things. But then how do we make sure that we're bringing those insights out of the community so then we can make it smarter that way?
Absolutely. I mean, the people who, and they also need some context. I mean, if everything was a locally based solution, then like there would be no, you need some sort of strategery around how it's all being put together. But ultimately, you know, I think we got a lot of folks who are in these positions to the point now where at least when they see a community and they see its problems and they come up with solutions before trying to implement them, they actually go and get feedback on the plan. And I would say that's a step in the right direction. But how about even better, before you come up with the solutions and decide which problems you're going to solve, you start with the people in the neighborhood and say, what are your problems? Really? What do you see as your big problem? Because frequently you won't hear the same answer. In Detroit, at least, crime is the perfect example. We see crime data in a neighborhood and we say, aha, we want more cops. But if you actually go and talk to the people in the neighborhood, they don't want more cops. They don't feel safer when the cops are there, to be honest. The cops don't seem to work for them. What they say is, I want to know more of my neighbors. I feel safer when I actually know my community more, et cetera, et cetera. So it really is, you can design better solutions. And that's obviously in urban planning is an easy way of thinking about that. But it's the same around in business. You know, when you design products without your end user telling you they want the product and telling you what the product should look like and how they're going to use the product, you're going to fail. We can't all be Steve Jobs or Henry Ford, who says, you know, the customer can have any color car he wants as long as it's black. Or, you know, I tell the customer what they're going to want. Like, those are the two examples that prove the rule. Everybody else who tries that goes out of business. So it really is the same thing across, you know, multiple sectors.
Mm, I totally agree. And I think it's not one or the other. So it's not just like, oh, yeah, come in and tell us, or okay, we let the community do everything, you know, themselves, or come up with everything themselves. Because also that's, you know, that's a big task, right? It needs to be structured. It needs to be, you know, there needs to be resources behind it. There needs to be funding behind it. These things just don't happen. And I think that's where we, in the smart community space, we have to see this radical shift of, and, you know, there may even be a new term for it. There'll be some hashtag that will come out soon, I'm sure. But rather than just engagement, it's how do we build together with our communities? And I think that's going to be such an interesting space, and it'll be a lot of, you know, teething issues to get started, and, you know, things will work, things won't work, but then we'll learn and we'll be able to move forward. Because I think when a community really feels like they actually have a say in how their community and city and region and even government works, then we'll be able to see that real level of engagement, that real level of co-creation or design or whatever we want to call it. Because until that happens, then it's not going to have the impact that we really want in the smart community space.
No, I completely agree. And you'll still have community members who are resistant to everything because they don't believe you. They'll just say, oh, yeah, we've heard all this before. You're going to come and do whatever you want. So for example, you know, we talked about people solving not the right problems. And I'll use public safety again, but here's one that's specifically around technology. So the powers that be have brought to bear in Detroit a ton of facial recognition technology to try and help stop crime. Unfortunately, there's a huge institutional racism problem in this, because apparently to the folks who write these algorithms, all Black people look the same. So they've now been arresting the wrong people, and it turns into a huge situation where the public thinks this is really just Big Brother trying to keep an eye on them and arrest them and occupy them more. And had you started with how do we solve this problem, not here's our solution, I think you would have come up with a much better answer. We wouldn't have wasted millions and millions of dollars. In fact, we're still investing in it. And I'm very frustrated by this because it's not solving even the stated problem. And it's causing a host of new ones, which is going to make it harder when we say, okay, you told us you needed last mile transit. And now we've got these apps and we've got these cameras that can help. And they're like, oh, wait, we know how you're going to use these. You're going to use it just like those police recognition ones where they arrested my brother when he was out of the city when some crime happened. So it really is a significant issue.
Yeah, I agree. And there's more diversity needed behind the code so then we can have better decisions made in front of the code. And I think that again needs a radical shift. It's not just, okay, we're going to have a program here and a program there that brings more diversity. And it's actually changing the whole conversation about what we want from our technology, which is one of the reasons I'm in the smart community space. You know, I'm an engineer by background, and, you know, people might think that's super high tech, but really I'm a civil engineer, right? I built roads to start with, but then upskilling and doing other things, realizing, oh, my skill set's actually in, you know, engagement, project management, understanding complex things and making them simple or explaining them in a simple way. Those type of things. And now I'm doing a master's of data science to try and bring those two things together. And also the rigor involved in engineering, I think, is something that we need in this space, because otherwise things don't happen because the quality is not there, or, you know, things don't happen to the standard that they need to happen, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, I think we need more people thinking differently behind when we're building these algorithms, building these things, but they need to not just be thinking differently, then need to be the ones with the skills to do the stuff, right? And I think people sometimes discount themselves because they think, oh, well, I can't be an engineer because I don't like math and, you know, I don't like physics and whatever else. But there's things that you can learn to do that. That's fine. And yeah, some people will be better at that than others. But also you can pick and choose those bits that you need. Yes, you might have to do them all to get through uni, but then what are the bits that you really, that really shine for you when we're building these solutions? Because not everyone needs to be able to code, but they need to be involved in the conversation and have an equal seat at the table too. I think that's a really important thing that we probably don't recognize enough. It's just like, oh yeah, we'll get the people in the room. But if they don't have the same voice, you know, the same recognition of their voice at the table, then it's not going to happen, right? It's not going to happen well. It's actually potentially could be worse because, you know, oh, well, we involved all these people, but we still got a terrible solution or an inadequate solution. And so I've been thinking more and more about how we change that narrative, you know, how we change that narrative to bring people into, not even bring people into tech, but actually community solutions that, yes, will involve tech because tech is part of our world now, right? And it has been for many years. But data and tech and those things that could that detrimentally affect our communities when we don't do this properly.
I couldn't agree more. It's interesting. You're an engineer who actually knows how to communicate and break things down and make them simple. You're like a unicorn, which is fabulous. We need more unicorns. It is funny, you know, at least here, everyone is STEM all the time. And I'm like, could you please stop? Because don't get me wrong, STEM is great. And being able to do the engineering is important. But if you can't communicate it to someone, if you can't critically think about why you're doing it, and so that you know, like, whoa, I should change this, because your overall goal is this, not just to build a road, but it was to, you know, provide X, Y, or Z. If you can't think like that, if you can't collaborate and work in a team, you know, the soft skills around that STEM, you know, I work in a place called Tech Town. I probably hire more English majors or, you know, poets than I do, you know, computer science majors. Because like you said, not everyone needs to actually do the coding. You have to understand what coding is and what it's for and all that. But there's a lot more around it that is just as, if not more, important.
And I also think demystifying it too, because I think what I find when, you know, oh, someone can code, oh, wow, they're magical, you know, and oh, they, all these things can happen, but you've got to understand what it can and it can't do as well. And also that the logic, right? The logic doesn't exist unless you can think about how this will work. Do you know what I mean? It's not just like, oh, yeah, can you code this thing for me? Oh, what do you want to do? Oh, I don't know yet. Okay, well, that's like the code is the tool, right? The code is the tool and it's a very powerful tool. And when you get good coders, they can make amazing things happen, but they're all real things. They're not magical things. And I think once we demystify that, then we can actually have those real conversations about what it can and can't do, but then also what we want it to do, because just because it can doesn't mean we want it to do that.
Which brings us back to the who's making those decisions about what do we want it to do and what should it do versus what, you know, what can it do? Those are important conversations to have, and not they aren't happening enough, unfortunately. But people are starting to, I think. I mean, I think fundamentally, if we could just get everyone to understand that they don't really know much about other people, or and that they'd be better off listening more than talking, says the guy who never shuts up. It would be well, you have a podcast. You're not allowed to stop talking, right? No dead air.
Otherwise, it'd just be awkward, right? So I tell myself every day, even when I'm not recording podcasts. Just to add, I think, like, I know I get told a lot that I'm an engineer that can communicate. I say, as I can't even say the word communicate, and that's rare. I actually think there are lots more people out there like me. However, they didn't choose engineering, if that makes sense. Like, they could do the engineering, but they didn't choose engineering because the narrative wasn't there. Oh, I don't want to be a boring engineer or whatever the case may be. I want to change the world. I want to, you know, solve climate change. I want to solve poverty, whatever, because those are the ideas that I had when I became an engineer. However, I don't know where I pulled that narrative from, to be honest, but the reason I chose engineering, I lived in a small regional town, right? And smart people above me were doing engineering, right? And I love math and science or whatever. So I was going to choose engineering regardless. So I didn't really need as much of a push to go into that space. However, other people that were, you know, just as capable as I was, they didn't choose engineering because it wasn't on their list, because they wanted to do X, Y, Z, which they could have done if they chose engineering, but they didn't realize that that was available to them or that engineering can lead that way. And so I think that changing of the narrative, whether it's engineering or science or the arts or whatever, I think if we can shift that narrative to that, and again, what are the problems you want to try to solve, bringing it back to smart communities, then we can have more well-rounded community conversations with professionals that then have an appreciation of not just, oh, math and science and whatever else, but actually, well, how do we bring the community? How can we communicate well? Because otherwise, it doesn't work. So I think, more multifaceted professionals. I don't even know if that's a word, but I think that's definitely something we need to see more and more of, and which I imagine you see a lot of in the space that you work in, when you've got people coming in and, you know, they're maybe traditional, you know, hairdressers or bakers or whatever, but how can they use different tools to improve their business and that type of thing as well?
Yeah, the most successful ones are. I mean, the most successful ones are the ones that are, you know, continuously learning and saying, you know, they don't try to pigeonhole themselves. You know, we deal with a lot of entrepreneurs, and generally speaking, as a rule, entrepreneurs are the kind of people that don't think of themselves as one thing because they can't, right? When you're a one-person company, you're the finance department and the marketing department and product development. Oh, you're the janitorial staff too, right? So it's harder to pigeonhole yourself. Now, a lot of these folks don't know a lot about some of these subjects, and that's where we come in to try to help them. You might be a great baker and you can, you know, make the step, but you don't understand the finance side. So you keep pricing stuff at the wrong point, or your inventory management is done wrong or whatnot. But the real successful ones are the ones that can pick up two or three of those disciplines and or be humble enough to know they don't know these things really well and build a team to offset those weaknesses.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was laughing while you're talking that, because as a small business owner, it's like, you're just like, oh, yes, I need to know how to do this now. And you're like, oh, geez, okay. And you have to do it, right? Particularly in the first instance, until you realize, oh, okay, someone else can do this much better than
I can. Something as a service that will do this for me at for half the cost of my brain power. I'm on it. Yes, that's great.
Yes. But yeah, you do need to have the, I guess, self-awareness of what you are and are not very good at, or don't want, or it's not your, I think, zone of genius is a word, but even just, you know, oh, someone could do this much better than I can. And it's not the thing that's driving my business, right? I'm doing the other stuff that the clients want, that I want to make an impact in the world and bring in the people that, yeah, their area is something that will enhance your business and you can continue to drive it. So yeah, definitely.
So that's ultimately when it comes down to a business, is if you're going to be successful, you have to decide, I like the term, what your zone of genius is. But really, you know, another way of saying that is, what's the area in which ultimately this business is going to be successful or not based on the success of X? In most cases, it's probably not the finance side or the janitorial side. It might be marketing. If you have a product that's just a commodity, but you can market it real well and make it cool and hip and whatever, I mean, people, you know, they pay two prices for the same beer or the same, you know, flat screen TV, the Vizio and the Samsung, which are made in the same factory, but, you know, you pay different prices for them. Maybe it's product. Maybe you're going to make the best thing ever, right? But then you have to decide, what's the thing that I'm going to do that's going to make or break my company? This is really a play. You know, occasionally it's financial engineering when you're just playing interest rates on something. That's not a very exciting company. But I used to trade financial derivative products, and that's all we did all day, sit around going, oh, I think I can make a, you know, 2 cents if I do this a million times. Okay, great. Let's do it. That was that kind of play. It was about an interest rate or a currency fluctuation. So that's the key to your business. Find your zone of genius. I'll footnote you the first time I say that.
Yes. Well, I can't claim full credit for that. Somebody said it, and there's a book about it, and I can't remember who it was. But we will put the link in the show notes.
Awesome. Take full credit. You get blamed for things that aren't your fault. Take credit for things that aren't your fault either.
Okay. Let's zoom into the future. And can you tell us about some of the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Oh, emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough. That's interesting. What are people not talking about enough? That's a hard qualifier, because everyone is talking about the electrification of the vehicle. Everyone is talking about connected and autonomous vehicles. I can see my Tesla outside from here, which is not autonomous, barely connected. But so people are talking about that and last mile transit. I got my vaccine, my COVID vaccine, so my 5G is good. Get great reception. What are people not talking about enough? So this is boring.
I love boring. I love boring stuff.
I think telemedicine is going to be a lot bigger than people think. I mean, COVID has demonstrated to us we can do a lot more in this regard. And we have a huge problem in various parts of the world with like access to healthcare for various reasons. And I think we're the advances we've seen just in the last year around telemedicine or teleconferencing is going to make telemedicine far more normal, and it's going to allow for far more increased access to healthcare everywhere. And I think that you'll end up getting a lot more patient compliance and better healthcare outcomes because people are going to be better connected, whether it's through chatbots and, you know, those kinds of, you know, AI solutions, or whether it's through more teleconferencing directly. I think just more remote stuff people are going to be more comfortable with.
Yeah, I agree. I think particularly in regional Australia and regional America and actually regional everywhere, just having that access is something that's really important. and, you know, not replacing necessarily having a doctor in areas at all, but where that's not available, how you can you supplement that with telehealth. And I mean, it's happening now. And I mean, even like school of the air and stuff like that, when I was growing up, which was, you know, my sister, you know, studied music and French, and she had to do both of those by, which was called, I think, school of the air or.
School of the air?
Yeah, school of the air. So it's like by distance education. And it was a real hassle back in the day because, you know, it was a phone and your stuff got like sent to you in the mail and, you know, that type of thing. Whereas now it's like, you know, this innovation, but it's been happening in regional Australia for many years because I grew up in a regional town and there was no music teacher, there was no French teacher, there wasn't the demand. So she was like, you know, one of the only students at her school, at my school, but then around Australia they would have all these other ones too. So I think a lot of this stuff is like just doing things better with technology and making it more accessible with technology and again, continuing to improve that process through continuing to ask the people that are using it what could make this better. I think that's, yeah, I don't find that boring at all. I think that's super interesting because then, you know, moves to things that are more advanced, like operating and being able to 3D print your own personalized health, you know, tablets or whatever you need, et cetera, et cetera.
That's the fancy stuff, right? So that's the exciting stuff. Oh, we're going to do personalized medicine by, you know, sequencing your entire genome, or we're going to be in an augmented reality operating theater where my heads up display is pointing out everything so I don't accidentally touch the wrong thing. Not that a doctor would ever do that, but they do all the time. But, you know, whatever, we'll have those kinds of things. That's the hot, you know, fancy, but just getting more people, more access to healthcare probably improves. That's low hanging fruit, you know, I think, at least it's the easy stuff, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But it makes a real impact in people's lives, which is why we're trying to do this. So there won't be any ribbon cutting. There won't be any shiny things, high fives. But in the community, there'll be multiple high fives because they'll be like, oh, now my grandma can access this doctor and get the care that she actually needs rather than, oh, I can't travel to an hour and a half, 3 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, whatever the case may be across the country to see this doctor. So I can't access.
So we've got a company that's been working on a platform for caregivers because your grandmother has two diseases and, you know, she's 87 and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so frequently, at least here, her care is split up between her three kids and five grandkids. And, you know, she has a nurse who might come in and et cetera at various times. And everyone is sort of in a hodgepodge of communication. Did you go see grandma? Did you take care of this? What did her doctor say about her blood pressure or whatnot? Well, imagine if you could all have that on one platform where, you know, the whole family was able to communicate, doctors and nurses were able to communicate. We could make sure she was taking her meds regularly and that little Johnny already gave her her blue pill. So you don't need to worry about that this afternoon, you know, those kinds of things. Again, it's not fancy, but it certainly, I think, could have an impact on a lot of different people's life. And we couldn't have done that 20 years ago. It would have been a notebook with, you know, people sketching when I was here, grandma took her meds, if we're lucky, right?
Yep. Yeah, no, I agree. Okay. I only have one more question, actually. It's been so great to chat with you, Ned. And I know we're running over a little bit of time. So very easy question. How can people connect with you?
So if you want to learn more about our work, techtowndetroit.org is the website. So it's all one word, techtowndetroit.org. And there you can find my contact information, obviously, but also you can hear about all the things we do, the clients we serve, and learn more about what we're doing to make Detroit a more equitable place.
Excellent. Thank you again, Ned, for coming onto the podcast. We will put all the links in the show notes and yeah, people can click away and find you. It's been great to chat and I look forward to our next conversation and I'm thinking it will be, well, hopefully we can talk before I can get over to Detroit, but we will have a coffee or a beer or whatever.
Excellent. Coffee on me. When you get over here, when this is all over and we can travel again. Although I think you guys already have it all sorted. It's us who we're waiting on, right?
It's not too bad here.
We'll catch up.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, nice talking with you.
Talk soon. Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're trying to deal with disruption, not sure what technologies to buy, need to facilitate genuine collaboration, then we can help. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community/consulting.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.